But I want to read this story to you, and I want you to consider it in a new light today. Starting in verse 1, it says this in John chapter 2. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Now, there are a lot of layers to this, and I want to kind of peel these back for you a little bit. Jesus and his disciples, they go to Cana in Galilee. They've been invited to this wedding. There is a lot of partying going on. And the first thing you need to know is that a wedding for a Jewish family in a Jewish community at that time would have taken several days to celebrate, not just a few hours on a Saturday afternoon, okay? So if that's not your bag and you're like, "I'd rather go home," this thing would have been like several days. There would have been feasting and drinking and dancing and all kinds of stuff like that going on. And all the kids and animals would have been running around underfoot the whole time, okay? Now, they're enjoying fine wine and they run out. And Jesus' mom says, "Come here, do something about this." He says, "No." To which she turns around and says, "Do what he says," right? Which, translation, "I'm your mom and you're going to do what I tell you to do," right? That's what's going on there. And so all the men are like, "Okay." And there are six stone water jars there, six of them, the kind used for ceremonial washing, each holding about 30 gallons. He says, "Fill the jars with water, and then draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." The master of the banquet says, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best until now." Sum it all up, John says, this was the first of Jesus' miracles, right? The very first. He's making a point to make sure that we know that. You have saved the best wine until now. What this means is that this is at this point in the party, most people are inebriated. Okay? They are inebriated. Everyone is drunk, and that's what's going on here. And this would not have been uncommon in an ancient Jewish wedding. And the reason I point this out is because that this is the first of Jesus' miracles. So let's be clear. One of the ways you tell how valuable a miracle is to ask the question, and put this question on the board for you, what would have happened if this miracle had not been performed? What's the big deal here? Why is John telling us about it in the first place? What would have happened if the miracle had not been performed? Well, you can apply this question to some of the other miracles, right? So what would have happened if Peter would have got out of the boat, you know, and he hadn't believed. He would have just sunk right away. What would have happened at the feeding of the 5,000? Everyone would have starved, right? Gone home hungry, that kind of thing. What would have happened if he hadn't healed the blind man? He wouldn't be able to see. So what about this miracle? Jesus turns water into wine. And I'm asking this question so we can be clear about what's going on here. He turns water into wine. If he hadn't have done the miracle, people would have sobered up. That's about it. People would have sobered up, the party would have ended, right? He made sure that a bunch of people who were already drunk, and I'm like, seriously, you got to help me out here, Jesus. I have to preach this stuff. It's in the Bible, okay? Let's do the math on this. If he didn't do this miracle, that would have meant the people would have sobered up. How offensive is this? Is this offensive to you? I think it's really clear that most people in this room, in our context and in our culture today, maybe not everybody, but most, that if Jesus were to show up today and perform the exact same miracle in our culture and in our context, we would find it extremely offensive. And if not offensive, we would have said it's at least inappropriate. I mean, I've been at weddings. I've officiated weddings where there are people who have had too much to drink. And it's not pretty. And they've had to be escorted out, and the police have been called to get them a ride home, or Lyft, or Uber. And there's varying degrees of badness when this happens, all right? Nobody appreciates it, least of all the bride and groom, second of all me, the pastor, and the bride and groom's family, third of all the venue staff who are having to deal with this in different ways. So if Jesus showed up today and did this, if it's not offensive, at bare minimum, it's completely unnecessary that he changed more water into a bunch more wine. We're talking a lot of wine. So you put it in today's terms, you're at a party, it's a kegger, someone runs out, they say, hey, there's no more beer. Jesus shows up and goes, hey, no problem. Boom, more beer. It's horrifying stuff, kind of. It's ugly, a little bit. How are you going to get out of this, preacher man? Here's what you need to understand. This whole thing about Jesus turning water into wine would not have been the least bit offensive to the Jewish culture and people of that day. They would not have been offended at all about him changing the water into wine. And the reason is because wine meant something different to them than it means to us. Wine, in this particular miracle, is actually absolutely crucial. So it may be weird that the supreme force of the universe, God, he comes down to earth, and the first miracle he's going to show and inaugurate and use to show the world how powerful a God he is to turn water into wine. And a bunch of people keep their buzz, you know. And that seems weird to us. That's what it looks like to us. But to the Jews, it didn't mean that at all, and it didn't look like that to them at all. The ancient rabbis had a saying, and it went like this: without wine, there is no joy. Which might seem like, you know, just matter-of-fact statement at the time. Maybe they wrote that statement when they had had too much to drink. I don't know. But there's a little bit more to it than that. For Jews, this language of without wine, there is no joy, it had its roots in the Old Testament. Wine is actually kind of this image throughout the Old Testament, along with honey and milk and fruit. Wine is one of those, and it has this, you find it there, and it creates this picture of God's incredible future abundant blessing. So wine is a symbol of what God is going to grant at some point in the future, and it's all throughout the Old Testament. So if you go back to the prophets, you can see this in several places. Amos chapter 9, verses 13 and 14. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when new wine will drip from the mountains and flow from the hills. I will bring back my exiled people Israel, and they will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. Joel chapter 3, verse 18. In that day the mountains will drip new wine, and the hills will flow with milk. Isaiah chapter 25, verse 6, and this is just a sampling, by the way. There's a whole lot more of this. If you read, you can just go to one of the websites that gives you a tool to search the Bible and put in the word wine, and you will find it everywhere. It says this in Isaiah chapter 25, on this mountain the Lord Almighty will prepare a rich feast of food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. Wine is a symbol of the incredible future abundance of blessings that God was going to bestow upon his people. That's what wine meant. So In fact, it was essential that the very first miracle out of the gate that Jesus had to use was the image of wine, and not just a small amount of wine. You're going to see in a minute, but he actually created enough wine for thousands of people to drink. And there were probably only about 300 people at this wedding from the context. So the finest, rarest wine flowing abundantly at this wedding, it would have smacked people right between the eyes. They would have remembered all of their Sunday school stories about if God's going to bless us, if we are going to receive His blessings of flowing milk and honey and fruit and wine, then that has to show up at some point. It has to be available at some point. So Jesus doing this at this wedding would have really caught their attention. It would have announced something very spectacular, the beginning of something amazing. What was Jesus saying in and through this miracle? He was saying that the future abundance and blessing that you've been waiting for, it is here, right now. He was telling them, I am here. This is where things start. This is where things change. This is the beginning of my ministry. So for those of us in this cultural context, the wine might be offensive, but for the Jews, not so much. Having said that, there is a part of this miracle, there's a part of this miracle that would have been extremely offensive to the Jews, but we just breeze right through it, and it's not offensive to us. Okay? And that is what happens, what's what we find in verse 6. In verse 6, if you look at verse 6 in your text, it says, Jesus filled... He filled the giant stone jars full of water and turned it into wine. What I want you to see is that it's the containers that would be offensive. The containers would have been offensive. And I want to explain that to you a little bit. In the ancient world, there were two different kinds of ways to hold wine. Two different kinds of wine containers. One was a little wine skin that you could attach to your belt or wear it around your neck, and you could use these wine skins, the same type of skin they would use for water, to hold water. Think of a little leather canteen type of thing. And you would use this small wine skin, you know, in a family setting, like at a small gathering. Way less people than are in this room right now. And then there is what is called a wine amphorae. A wine amphorae. A wine amphorae was used for more large gatherings. Like, it's what we would use here if we were going to have wine at our chili cook-off today. All right? It's what would be used at this wedding that Jesus was at with his disciples. All right? Here is a picture of what a wine amphorae looks like. Pretty big. It has a very distinct shape, has handles on the sides. Okay? And they come in various sizes. They were made of clay. And you'll notice that there's this narrowing down at the base. You guys see that? Let's go to the next picture. I'll show you a few more. Different style, but they still all narrow at the base, and they've got the handles at the top. They were designed very deliberately that way for the transportation process during that day. These would have been transported all over the Mediterranean world. From Greece and other places. And the main mode of transportation for these was by boat. So imagine the bottom of a boat that comes down like this, and in the very bottom of the hull, and that's where they would store these when they were transporting them from city to city. Okay? So they designed the amphorae just like that, so that they would place them in the bottom of the boat very carefully, kind of staggering them like this, so that the pointed shape at the bottom would kind of, in the bottom of the boat, act like a zipper, kind of like put them together like a zipper. Does that make sense? Otherwise, because they were made of clay, they were fairly fragile. You stack them in there like that, and then they had much less of a chance of breaking because they were pretty delicate. So they would place them very carefully down in there, and they were more stable and secure, and they would get to where they needed to go. That's the way why they're shaped that way. And you got the two handles, and the spout at the top is narrow enough for them to put a stopper in it so that it won't leak, some type of cork or cap or something like that, right? But it's also, once it's empty, it's also big enough that they can refill it easily. And it was pretty expensive to make these types of jars, okay? So this is what the text says, they had ran out of wine. If they had run out of wine, and wine was in these, I want you to imagine these amphorae stacked up in the corners, lying outside the front door, maybe littered around the big banquet table or whatever, or out in the courtyard. They've run out of wine, so they got a bunch of empty amphorae laying around. Okay? So, Jesus, into this scene, comes along, and he does something really strange. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind the Jews used for ceremonial washing, each holding about 30 gallons. And John, he includes these details because he wants to make sure we don't miss it. He's like, open your eyes and see what's going on here. This is the actual stone jar. I want to show you the picture of the ceremonial stone washing jar. Okay? It's huge. It's huge. This one is in a museum and it's behind plexiglass, plastic, to keep people's hands off of it. I don't know if you can see, but to the left of it, there's a guy standing there. Let's go to the next one. You'll see it a little bit better. This is how big they are. Huge. Huge. It's a giant stone 30-gallon jar, and there are 6 of these. Lots of water. Do the math. It's 180 gallons. 180 gallons for ceremonial washing and purity. These things are almost as high as a person. Can you see that? Kind of at least up to your chest, sometimes up to your shoulder, depending on how tall you are. So let me explain to you why this would have been incredibly offensive. For the ancient Jews, when they came in and did a ceremonial washing before a wedding ceremony, and they would wash, and they would wash throughout the several days of the ceremony. They would do this at other types of gatherings for the people as well. But this was about ceremonial purity. It was about ritual purity. This was about spiritual cleanliness. And here's how it worked for the Jews. In order to be in the presence of God, because God is holy, you have to be clean to be in His presence. So the entire religious system emerges around the clean, what is clean, and what is unclean. And then there's all these rituals to make sure that you can stay clean so that you can be in the presence of God. But here you are at a wedding, and you're about to have this big celebration, or you're in the middle of it, around the gift that God has given the people called marriage. And you got to make sure you're clean. And the host has lots of these ceremonial jars, 6 of them at this particular wedding. And he has them there to make sure that you can do your ceremonial washing, to make sure that you're clean in advance and during the event. And then periodically during the event you come back and you get clean again, because it would last for several days. So that's what happens. So what I want you to see is that at the center of the Jewish mindset and imagination was this issue of, I got to be clean. I have to be clean, or I can't be at these good things, and I can't celebrate in the right way, and I can't be in God's presence unless I'm clean. Cleanliness to them was brought about by separation. And what I mean by that is you separate yourself and you keep clean by keeping away from the things that are going to make you unclean. So this is what is going on when Jesus walks up to a leper who is unclean. Everybody else is going, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're going to become unclean, even if you don't catch the disease. You're going to have to go do a bunch of work to become clean again. You're going to have to go be purified. So cleanliness was brought about by separation and keeping things apart. Let's put that slide up there. One thing, can be good in and of itself, actually. And another thing can be good in and of itself in their way of thinking. But if you combine those two things in the Jewish mindset, two good things, if you combine them, they actually become unclean. They shall not overlap, is what it says in the Old Testament. Think about oil and water. They separate, but they dirty each other. So, how many of you are familiar with the term kosher? Kosher. You've heard of kosher, right? Hebrew National Hot Dogs. Costco, you know? Keeping kosher. Here's one example of keeping kosher. You can eat meat, And you can eat milk, both wonderful things, right? But meat and dairy cannot be used together. It's not kosher. Meat and dairy can't be used together. So, what does this mean for us? Huh? Oh, cheeseburgers. Most Mexican food is off the table. This is evil to me. But there's a reason for this. There's a method to this madness, all right? The meat, in order to eat meat, this is the thinking that's behind it. In order to eat meat, you must kill something. Contrary to popular opinion, you know, I just go to the grocery store and pick it up, you know? In order to eat meat, you must kill something. Something must die. Something must die. And so meat is a symbol of death. Whereas dairy and milk, something must be living in order to provide milk. And milk sustains life. Milk is a symbol of life. Meat is a symbol of death. And life and death do not touch. They do not touch. That's the thinking behind it. You can't mix meat and dairy. Okay? Life and death should not, cannot, at any time, meet. They defile and contaminate each other, and you will lose your kosherness, and you will contract a spiritual disease called tuma. This is what it is to be kosher. This is what ceremonial washing, this is what all this stuff is about with these stone jars in this story. It's about keeping two things separate. You can have wine. You can have wine. Wonderful, beautiful containers, amphorae of wine. And you're welcome to have them. And we can set aside this water in these jars for ritual washing. But you do not mix them. And he says, put the water in the ceremonial stone jars. And then it's wine. The two shall not meet. In so doing, you defile both and you disease yourself. And so Jesus, in the midst of all these, remember, there are a ton, because the wine has run out, there are a ton of refillable amphorae wine containers laying all around. They are easily accessible, even if they've been stacked out behind the house. And he doesn't say, go get one of those. He says, fill those over there. Fill those. This is a giant slap in the face to the people at the party. Great, Jesus. Nice going. You've now diseased all of us, is what people are probably thinking. We're at this wedding and none of us can get ritually pure because you took all the jars and turned them into wine. And while we like that, we don't like that. Why would Jesus do this? Why would he do this? Why would he do it in this way? Truly, it's very offensive. It would have been very offensive to them. First miracle out of the gate. I'd like to introduce you and announce my ministry on its inaugural day. I'd like to offend you all now. You know? And make sure you're all spiritually unclean. Right? Come follow me. The reason that Jesus did this is because it's a metaphor for his entire ministry. It's a metaphor for his entire ministry. It's a foreshadowing. It's a metaphor for the way that Jesus is going to be operating in the lives of the people that he is calling to follow him. Here is what Jesus understood, and I want you to understand this well. Religions have this tendency to get extremely rigid. Religions have a natural trajectory to become increasingly brittle over time. It is really, really rare for a religion to remain limber and pliable and flexible and responsive to flow in movement. And the reason for this is because religions emerge for the very purpose of preservation. Something really amazing and dynamic and dramatic happened at the birth of Christianity that we wanted to it was so amazing and transformative and so beautiful that we wanted to create structures to retain and preserve and make sure that that thing would live on. And that's necessary, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and it's good. But at some point, religions have this ability to turn on themselves and constrict and suffocate the very thing that was so beautiful. It's a struggle to remain responsive. And it's not just religions, by the way. This happens to each and every one of us individually as well. So our souls, in order to grow, must remain limber and flexible and bendable. And the best way to prevent a building, I've read up a little bit about this after moving to Seattle. Apparently we're supposed to have this big earthquake at some point, right? So the best way to prevent a building from collapsing when an earthquake happens is to construct that building in such a way, right, that it can actually bend and sway, right, and swoon when the earth shakes. Because if it doesn't do this when the earth shakes and it doesn't bend, it cracks and it breaks and it falls down. So this water into wine, this is a lesson in the physics of spirituality, really. That which doesn't bend breaks. That which doesn't bend breaks. And this is one of the most painful parts of following Jesus. This is a painful thing about following Jesus. One of the most difficult and painful parts of following him is that he has this incredible habit, incredible, an annoying habit, almost. No, it's annoying. Let's be honest about it. Of taking things that we hold very dear. He takes things that we hold very dear, things that we believe to be sacred. We believe them to be sacred. Things that we are deeply attached to, that give us meaning, that give us life. Things like ritual purity washing stations that were essential at the heart of their religion. Jesus has a habit of subverting those and upending those and messing with them. It is very easy to say, if you open up your program on the right-hand page at the bottom where we've put our definition for discipleship, it is very easy to say that we want to be a disciple of Jesus, but in spending time with him so you can be more like him, so you can do the things he did for the reasons he did them for, he will mess with you. He will mess with all of us if you decide to do what that statement says. So this water to wine thing is a metaphor. This whole thing is a metaphor for how growth happens. How we grow is connected to this passage. Jesus comes along and basically says to us, what you've got is good and all, but I want to take you somewhere further. We need to go over there. You need to go a little bit further beyond that. I've got something more for you. And this is important because Jesus, he didn't come along and condemn what the Jews were doing. He didn't say to them at this moment, you're doing it wrong. He didn't say that. He didn't say that at all. What Jesus did was offensive, but it wasn't destructive. It wasn't destructive. It was actually really, really creative what he did. He actually started, you'll notice that he didn't come in and say, this is wrong, and smash all those jars. He didn't smash them all. He didn't start beating them with a sledgehammer and saying, this is wrong. Okay? He didn't come in and say, these are horrible, we've got to get rid of them, they're terrible. He didn't say any of that. He said he included these jars in the new thing that he was doing. Right? He said, fill up those jars. I'm going to do something new with them right now. It might offend you, but it's what you need. It's a really creative thing that he's doing. So what he does, it affirms where they started, but it draws them beyond. And it includes where they were. And this is what it means for us to be growing. He affirms where we start, but he draws us further along. He doesn't get rid of where you came from or what you've done in the past, but he includes that and says, now we need to grow. We need to move beyond that. God coming to us and saying things like, where you are is really good. It's beautiful. And the things that you're attached to right now are serving you well. But where I want to take you, you may not need those things anymore. In fact, you may not want those things anymore. Where I want to take you, those things, they're not going to do what they used to do anymore. Where I want to take you, you may still hold on to those things, but they're going to function very, very differently than they used to. Instead of jars for purification, these jars are now jars for celebration. Okay? Instead of jars for, I've done bad, and there's a consequence for my bad, and I need to be made clean and good, Jesus comes along and says, now I give you jars of celebration because I am here and the good news has arrived and you have an opportunity to join me in this great new grand and glorious kingdom where we're going to celebrate God's presence. So we're not getting rid of the jars. I'm just changing them in order for us to grow. How many of you have seen the movie Back to the Future? Raise them high. That's very good. For those of you who haven't, I highly recommend it. Can't believe you haven't seen it. It came out in 1985. It's a true story. For those who... Just kidding. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's a true story. It's a true story. Okay? It's based on a true story. Let's just say that. No, it's not true. It's about a mad scientist, right? Doc Brown. Who creates a time machine out of a DeLorean, right? Out of a DeLorean. And the whole story is basically this. The DeLorean requires two things in order to travel through time. Number one, it requires a certain amount of energy in order to fuel it. Can anybody tell me how many gigawatts are required? Anybody? 1.21 gigawatts. Ding, ding, ding. 1.21 gigawatts of electricity or of power. And the only way you can find that is if you have weapons-grade plutonium or a bolt of lightning. Right? Because in 1955, when they go back in time, there's no electricity that can create that much. There's no source. Right? So weapons-grade plutonium, which is very dangerous, right? Or 1.21 gigawatts of electricity provided by a bolt of lightning. So the movie is all about how are they going to find that energy to get from 1955, which they've traveled back to 1985. So first, it requires a certain amount of energy. Number two, the second thing that the car requires is a certain amount of space, right? A certain length of road, so that they can get up to a certain speed. And then when they get up to that certain speed, time is triggered, and then they can jump through time. And that speed is 88 miles per hour. Wow, you guys, yeah. This side is winning, by the way. Just this side over here. You guys need to up your game here a little bit. 88 miles per hour. So the DeLorean needs two things, right? The DeLorean, you got to have 1.21 gigawatts of electricity, which either comes from a bolt of lightning or plutonium, and you got to have enough road to get up to 88 miles per hour, and you have to have the 88 miles per hour and the electricity converge at the same time to help the time machine, the sweet-looking DeLorean, you know, jump through time. And as the movie unfolds, Doc Brown, it's at the end of the movie, Doc Brown, the creator of the DeLorean, he goes off into the future, right? He goes off into the future, and then he returns almost immediately. He returns urgently from the future, and he says to Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, hey, you got to come with me. You got to come with me. Where does he have to come with him to? Back to the... And he says, back to the future. We got to go back to the future because something bad has happened. And Marty says, okay. And all of a sudden, Doc Brown, he reaches over and he takes a bunch of garbage. Right? He reaches into the garbage can. I think there's a banana peel and some other stuff. He dumps some leftover, like, moldy rotten cheese or something, milk or something into it. into the flux capacitor, which is kind of like the fuel tank, right? And suddenly, all of a sudden, you realize he does not need 1.21 gigawatts of electricity, or he does, and whatever this contraption is converts everyday, you know, compost into that. He doesn't need plutonium, and he's got enough energy to travel through time. And Marty and Doc, they hop into the car. Marty's like, whoa, okay, I guess we have a fuel source. And he goes, hey, he pulls out and he looks down the road, and Marty McFly says to him, hey, we don't have enough road to get up to 88 miles per hour. And Doc Brown, he's got these futuristic wraparound silver shades, right? He drops them down. What does he say? He says, roads? We don't need roads. Where we're going, we don't need roads. What I guess I'm trying to say is that Jesus is like a 1980s movie mad scientist. Jesus comes to these Jews and says, jars for purification? You don't need those anymore. I'm here for purification. I'm here for purification. Where I'm taking you, you won't need these jars anyway. There's nothing wrong with them. You're just not going to need them where we're going. Just like Doc Brown said, roads? We don't need roads. We're not going to need them where we're going. So the question for every single one of us, we're in this new season of fall. This is the first Sunday of fall, by the way. Happy fall. The question for every single one of us as we look forward to our future, a joyful future where God is saying, we get to celebrate. That's why we like to eat together, right? Have a few times together. The question for every one of us in this room is, how flexible, how open, how limber is your soul to be able to respond to the thing that Jesus is always going to do to you if you're serious about following Him, if you're serious about growing? What Jesus will always do if you want to grow is He will confront, He will get in your face, He will upend, He will disrupt the things that you hold most dear and sacred. And it might even offend you. It might even offend you. And our ability to respond to the Spirit of God moving in this place and in this world and grow is directly proportionate to how limber our souls are. How able are we when Jesus contaminates those things that we think are sacred, when He contaminates them with wine? How able are we to go, okay, that hurts a little bit. That might even hurt a lot. But I can get there. We can get there. Do any of you have a sense that God is asking you to grow? And if so, is there anything you're holding on to that is preventing that growth? It's something that is good, maybe, not something that's bad. Something good that you're holding on to, like those sacred washing jars. Is there anything as a community of faith that we hold on to that prevents God from moving us forward? Let's pray together that we have the wisdom to see what those things are and that our souls are open enough and malleable enough to respond.